Welcome to Power Play. On the program today, will Russia invade?
If any assembled Russian units move across the Ukrainian border, that is an invasion.
The U.S. readies for a Russian invasion. What should Canada do? We will talk to Russia's ambassador to Canada in just a minute, so stand by for that. We'll get his view. And opening Ontario, the province will start lifting Omicron restrictions at the end of the month, but is the premier following the science? Is it too fast or too slow? We'll debate that. Plus, no clean water again. Is safe water a pipe dream in Iqaluit? The city's water treatment plant is shut down again because of fuel contamination. What is the fix? We'll speak to the mayor of Iqaluit today. This is Power Play. Let's get right to the players.
We firmly oppose Russian aggression and military action against Ukraine. We reject Russia's false narrative that Ukraine or NATO are threats. The recently launched diplomatic process offers Russia two options. They can choose meaningful dialogue or swift, severe consequences.
Threats of severe consequences. Is Canada preparing to respond to the Russian invasion of Ukraine with what? Tougher sanctions, sending weapons there? Is a Russian invasion imminent? Well, the U.S. and the NATO allies clearly believe it is, but talks to de-escalate the situation keep failing. Now, check this out. These images released by the Russian Defense Ministry show the Navy conducting a series of military drills, including missile tests. The drills were reportedly taking place this month and next with more than 140 warships, 60 aircraft, and 10,000 sailors and soldiers participating. Meantime, more than 100,000 combat-ready Russian troops are amassed on the Ukrainian border in the east. So how will NATO respond? There were certainly mixed messages from the U.S. Last night, President Biden suggested the U.S. may tolerate a minor Russian, as he called it, incursion into Ukraine. Listen to this.
Russia will be held accountable if it invades, and it depends on what it does. It's one thing if it's a minor incursion, and then we end up having a fight about what to do and not do it.
Okay, well, that caused a huge stir, and late last night, that statement was retracted. So where are we now? Let's ask CTV News Washington correspondent Richard Madden about that. Rich, good to see you. What is the U.S.'s position today?
Yeah, a whole lot of confusion and a whole lot of cleanup happening at the White House. Moments after President Biden said that comment that you just played moments ago at his marathon press conference last night, we saw a tweet from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky saying, quote, "We want to remind the great powers that there are no minor incursions and small nations, just as there are no minor casualties and a little grief from the loss of loved ones." So a lot of concern, a lot of shock, and a whole lot of surprise. This morning and last night, Press Secretary Jen Psaki issuing a clarification, a correction, and then earlier today, President Biden went in front of the cameras and said this. Take a listen.
I've been absolutely clear with President Putin. He has no misunderstanding. If any assembled Russian units move across the Ukrainian border, that is an invasion.
Okay, so clear again this time, Evan. President Biden, just moments ago, was asked another question at the White House. This is from the Pool Report. The question was from a Fox News reporter saying, quote, "Why are you waiting on Putin to make the first move, sir?" And the president's response was, quote, "What a stupid question." So some frustration clearly showing at the White House. This is supposed to be the one-year anniversary of the Biden presidency. He was hoping to reset his agenda and reshape events. But clearly, events are taking over him, and his White House is scrambling to really clarify this message.
Secretary Blinken set to start high-level talks with his Russian counterpart tomorrow again. Yeah. What do we know about that, and what do we know about the approved shipments of American-made weapons from allies to Ukraine?
Yeah, well, we do know, Evan, that the administration has just informed Congress that they're going to give Ukraine five transport helicopters. The administration is also giving permission to the Baltic countries of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia to send U.S.-made weapons to Ukraine. So that includes air defense systems and a Javelin anti-tank weapons and other artillery. So the U.S. and their allies are moving with sort of some sort of symbolic showing of weapons. But the question, Evan, is if all NATO nations are united against what they perceive as a Russian threat. And generally speaking, they are when it comes to sanctions. But individually, just how far these European allies of NATO are willing to push that Russian bear remains to be seen.
Yeah, and of course, the Russians have a pipeline going into Germany of natural gas. They haven't actually kickstarted it yet, but that is very, very key as a strategic weapon for the Russians and leverage over Europe if they actually get that thing up and running. CTV News, Richard Madden, I appreciate your perspective as always, Rich. Thank you, sir.
You bet.
Canada's Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly has just left Ukraine, and she, as we saw earlier, promised sanctions on Russia should there be an invasion. Canada already has more than 200 troops training the Ukraine military in-country, and the Special Forces have been part of that. It's called Operation Unifier. And a Canadian frigate is sailing into the region to support the NATO mission there. But Canada has not yet committed to send weapons to Ukraine. Remember, Russia illegally annexed part of Ukraine in 2014, the Crimean Peninsula. So is another invasion coming? What's the Russian view of this? Let's find out. Joining me now is the Russian ambassador to Canada, Oleg Stepanov. Ambassador, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. Hello.
People want to know, why is Russia amassing 100,000 troops on the border of Ukraine? Is Russia preparing to invade that country?
No, absolutely not. Russia is conducting regular exercises on its own territory, and there is no intent to invade Ukraine.
The U.S. and NATO believe that these are not regular, that these are combat-ready troops, that there's no reason to have 100,000 troops on eastern Ukraine, and much like Russia did in 2014 when it, in Canada's view, illegally invaded and annexed part of the Crimean part of Ukraine, the Crimean Peninsula. Is this a provocation towards war?
Absolutely not. I know that we agree to disagree about the status of Crimea and how it happened. But once again, I want to officially state that there is no desire, no intent to invade Ukraine, no intent to create any sort of situation that would lead to conflict in that particular region.
So if there is no intent, is your country peace talks keep breaking down, why then, as a sign of good faith, why not move some of those troops away from the border?
Well, you know, there are a couple of things. First of all, it's a principle of sovereignty, and Russia can do anything on its own territory, and of course, we would never move our troops in our territory at the behest of the foreign countries. That's one thing. The second thing is that it's not the peace negotiations, as you put it. It's the invitation from the Russian government to engage in comprehensive security dialogue between Russia and the United States, between Russia and NATO. We are discussing a number of topics there. What is most important for us is non-expansion of NATO, that NATO returns its infrastructure and national deployments to the status of 1997, and that we can proceed with securing a comprehensive security arrangement for the Europe in order to provide for the equal indivisible security both for each and every member of the European continent.
Right. NATO's response is that NATO determines who is a member of NATO or not, and that NATO is a defensive pact. It is not an offensive pact. It is no threat to Russia. In fact, it is there as a defense against Russian expansionism. The NATO allies, as you know, cite not only the annexation illegally of Crimea, but the invasion and occupation of Georgia in 2008, what they see as the illegal troops in Moldova. There's lots of precedent. That's why NATO's worried more about, and by the way, what their support of militant groups in eastern Ukraine, in the Donbass. NATO's worried about Russian expansionism, not vice versa, sir.
Well, it's a Western point of view, and from the point of view of Moscow, NATO was steadily encroaching towards the Russian borders. deploying combat infrastructure right at the steps of St. Petersburg and our Western cities. And since you declare that in each and every summit of NATO, you declare that NATO remains a nuclear alliance, it practically means that the nuclear armed alliance is basically tower steps when each missile launched from, hypothetically, of course, launched from the NATO base can reach Moscow in 10 to 15 minutes. So please understand us that we don't feel very much secure when NATO is expanding right toward our borders. And, you know, I wouldn't comment because it's about Georgia, because it's a very well documented story. There was an independent commission established by the European Union by Ambassador Heidi Tagliavini, who, with facts on paper, proved that in 2008, on the 8th of August 2008, Mr. Saakashvili, who was president at that time, ordered a military action, a military operation against civilian population of the city of Tskhinval, which is the capital of South Ossetia, which at that time was a part of Georgia, as Abkhazia. But because of that reckless war, actually, the war started when Mr.
Saakashvili... Okay, but let's not debate Georgia, although I think Georgia is important. I just want to focus on Ukraine. The Ukrainians have focused on the 4,500 Ukrainian soldiers who died fighting what they say Russian-backed separatist forces in the east. I know our foreign affairs minister even visited the wall in Kiev about that. But let me just quickly, if I can, get some of your reactions. Canada has now threatened that if Moscow invades or intrudes on sovereign Ukraine territory, or further does it, there will be sanctions. What would the Russian response be for more sanctions from Canada?
Well, you know, in our view, it's general, philosophically, sanctions never work. And sanctions never will be able to work against such countries, such nation as Russia. The attempts to use sanctions as threat in order to make Russia to do certain steps on international arena is just an illusion. Actually, in Russia and in Russian government, and I can tell you frankly, nobody cares about Western sanctions anymore. And
no one cares about economic sanctions against Russia?
Yes, because they don't work and they do not bite. They do not inflict any real influence or any... there are no practical outcome.
Whether Russia's not afraid of increased sanctions. Okay, well, how would Russia respond to Canada sending defensive military weapons to Ukraine? Ukraine has asked. Canada has not made a decision. What would Russia's response be on that?
Well, frankly speaking, as a person who been dealing for many years with political and military affairs, I do not understand that term like defensive weapons. It's more like a political term. Weapons are weapons. And our position is that any shipments of weapons to the country, like Ukraine, which is in the middle of civil war, practically, it's not conducive to any peaceful initiatives that should be undertaking on the diplomatic track.
Okay.
So it's just the fueling the conflict and emboldening the hotheads in Kyiv who have illusions that they can start a military operation and to take eastern Ukraine by force.
Ambassador, I know you say it's a civil war there. Again, the NATO position is that it's Russian-backed forces that are destabilizing eastern Ukraine. It's not a civil war at all. How would Russia respond to Canada extending its military training mission Unifier there? What would the Russian response be?
Well, you know, we have many concerns about that mission, but not about the mission per se, because obviously, in general, it's a sovereign decision of two countries who trained whom and what experience to share. But my only concern as an ambassador to Canada was reading in the Canadian newspapers, in major media outlets, that Canadian military and Canadian journalists discovered that through that operation, through Operation Unifier, a number of, dozens actually, of neo-Nazi members of such detachments as Azov, who are blacklisted even by your southern neighbor, United States, they were trained in Operation Unifier. And as far as I know, the Ministry of Defense of Canada is now conducting the investigation, how that could happen. And for me, it would be very interesting to see what would be the result of such an investigation.
Okay, just because, and I know you and I will speak again on Sunday, sir, but Canada's got special forces on the ground. We're looking. They've made a message to Russia, do not invade. Just very quickly, what is your message back to Canada?
Well, once again, as far as I know, those special forces are deployed there since autumn 2020 on a rotational basis. They provide security for the embassy and some other, fulfill some other tasks. So we do not look at that as something extra to what Canada used to have on the ground. But once again, my opinion and my signal would be is that the less military is on the foreign military on the ground in Ukraine, the more success, the more chances of success for diplomatic settlement of the conflict in the East Ukraine.
All right, Oleg Stepanov, the Russian ambassador to Canada, sir. I really appreciate this, and we hope this does not escalate to a conflict. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Okay, interesting. Russia clearly dismissing the idea that sanctions don't work, they don't bite. We'll pick that up later in the program on the Press Gallery, but coming up, opening Ontario.
We do see hope that the sacrifices have been worth it by the businesses affected.
Province is getting ready to end Omicron restrictions. Is it time to move on, or is the province risking a resurgence? Too slow, too fast? Ontario's Liberal leader joins us with his perspective next. Stay with Power Plant.
We're not out of the woods yet. The coming weeks will continue to pose real challenges, especially to our hospitals. But these are challenges our hospital system can manage. We can be confident in our ability to care for people, to provide hospital beds to those who need them, and we can be confident that the worst is behind us.
Okay, so that's Premier Doug Ford of Ontario announcing the three-step reopening part two. He says his government will begin easing COVID-19 restrictions in this three-phased approach starting at the end of the month. As of January 31st, Ontario will increase its social gathering limits to 10 people indoors and 25 people outdoors, while allowing restaurants, bars, and other similar businesses without dance floors to open at 50% capacity. Sporting and concert venues and theaters can also operate at 50% capacity or capped at 500 people, whichever is less. 21 days later, gathering limits will bump up to 25 people indoors and 100 people outdoors. Capacity limits will be lifted for indoor settings requiring the vaccine passport and increased for places without vaccine passport requirements where physical distancing can be maintained. Then March 14th, that's the final stage, that will see capacity limits to all indoor public spaces lifted, including for religious services. Indoor gatherings will be raised to 50 people with no caps on outdoor gatherings. Ontario's Chief Medical Officer of Health, Dr. Kieran Moore, says the decision to start reopening was made due to positive indicators that COVID-19 transmission in the province was starting to ease. But Ontario's Omicron peak has yet to pass. COVID-19 cases are expected to peak later this month, with the peak in hospitalizations lagging behind by a couple weeks. Of course, you've also got in-school learning in Ontario, which has not even been back a full week yet. Is the Ford government jumping the gun on the reopening plan? And with a lack of testing access in Ontario, is the province pinning its reopening on limited data? Or is it going too slow, as some argue? We did ask for an interview with any member of the Ford government today. They said no one was available. But we have the Liberal leader of Ontario, Stephen Del Duca, joining us. Mr. Del Duca, thanks for joining us. What do you make of the reopening plan, January 31st, as step one?
Well, thanks for having me back on, Evan. So I've said all the way through that Doug Ford needs to be careful, needs to be thoughtful. We've got to move in a way that's methodical based on what the doctors and the science are telling us. So look, at first glance, this notion of January 31st being the first moment when we can slowly start to reopen a little bit, you know, I can accept that. But I think there are still other things Doug Ford needs to be doing right away to make sure that we are set up for success and that we don't go backwards once again. So what I called for today was to have the booster shot, the third dose of the vaccine, become a requirement or a part of the vaccine certificate in Ontario. We've seen about 6 million people in the province who've gotten their booster shots so far. That is good progress, but we need more people to step up and get the booster shot. So I wanted to add it to the vaccine certificate. I think it will help us.
Yeah, Doug Ford says no, they're going to keep the vaccine passport requirement at 2. You wanted at 3. Now, what do you make of the fact that the premier said the worst is behind? Dr. Kieran Moore said the peak hospitalization is yet to come. We know there's always a lag, yet many businesses, sir, are saying you got to reopen now. We are dying. Is the phased approach the right approach?
Well, I do think the phased approach is the right approach, from a general perspective. But one thing I am concerned about, not for the first time today, we heard Doug Ford again talk about a timeline that extends for many, many weeks from now. When we don't have all of the data, you pointed out in the introduction, we've just seen our schools reopen across the province. So my strongest advice to Doug Ford, add the booster shot to the vaccine certificate. Let's watch really carefully to see what's happening as a result of the schools reopening. Let's keep a close eye on the ongoing surges that we see in nursing homes and hospitals. And if we have to reconsider the timeline, let's do that as soon as possible. I want us to get back to normal.
To be fair, isn't that exactly what Doug Ford's saying? He said it's a phased approach. If we see a rise in hospitalizations, we'll rethink the timeline. Aren't you saying same thing he's saying?
No, I don't think it's the same thing at all for a couple of reasons. One is he's not prepared to add the booster shot to the vaccine certificate. Number two, he has not taken the steps, made the effort or the investment necessary to keep our schools safe, our kids and our frontline education workers safe. He hasn't repealed Bill 124 so we can get more nurses into our nursing homes and in our hospitals. There's a series of things I think he should be doing rather than simply telling us as a slogan that the worst is behind us. This virus doesn't respect slogans or politics. We need to take every step necessary to make sure that we can get beyond this ordeal.
Okay, and just so our audience knows, Bill 124, of course, a bill that froze the pay for people like nurses. Nurses want that repealed, so they believe higher pay might, in fact, attract more nurses and get rid of the shortages. So that's been a big debate in your province. Ontario Liberal leader Stephen Del Duca, I appreciate you joining us. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Evan. Take care.
All right, meantime, a Florida man has been charged with human smuggling after the RCMP in Manitoba found the bodies of 4 people, including an infant and a teen, near the Canada-U.S. border. This is so heartbreaking. The 2 adults, 1 teenager and an infant, were found near Emerson, Manitoba, along the border with North Dakota on Wednesday. They are believed to have died from exposure during a blizzard and freezing temperatures. U.S. officials say 47-year-old Steve Shand has been arrested and charged. He will remain in custody until a hearing, which is set for Monday. Coming up, water crisis again. Is Iqaluit's water contaminated again? Why does the whole city suddenly come under a boiled water advisory just months after the plant was shut for the same problem? We'll find out why from the mayor of Iqaluit. He's on the other side of a short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Power Play. Iqaluit is in hot water again, literally. The city is under a cautionary boiled water advisory while it deals with a second fuel contamination in its water treatment plant. Residents being told to boil all water they plan to drink or use to wash their food for at least 1 minute. This is the second time in 3 months that Iqaluit has faced a fuel contamination issue. Last year, residents went nearly 2 months without safe tap water. Is Iqaluit staring down another lengthy boil water advisory? And what will it take to get the city a new water treatment center. Joining me now is the Iqaluit Mayor, Kenny Bell. Great to have you back, sir, and I hope you're well. What happened this time?
Yeah, thank you for having me. So, you know, last week we got more complaints about the fuel smell in people's waters. And, you know, our S-CAN unit, which monitors hydrocarbons in our water, did show small trace amounts, 50 micrograms, which is basically where it's testable, in our system on Monday and Wednesday, and then again just yesterday, Wednesday morning, again. So we put on a bypass, which is now making us do a boil water advisory.
How long are you expecting this to last?
Well, the bypass is bypassing our treatment center, and it is the water is still being treated by UV and by chlorine, but we have to make sure that the chlorine is within Canadian standards. So that's why the boil water advisory is. Once we get those levels back to normal, then it will be you know, just regular water service. But there's going to be some time before the plant is back and operational again.
Yeah, and that timeline's key. By the way, you and I spoke earlier. You said, in the meantime, residents are literally going to the river. It's minus 28 or minus 30 there. They're having to use augers to basically drill through the ice and get water from the river. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, and again, people have done this for the beginning of time and will do it for forever moving forward as well. It's just the amount of people. It's a number of people obviously don't trust the system, and rightfully so. And you know, they're worried and concerned. So they've been going out and collecting river water just to substitute instead of boiling.
So, okay. So give us a sense, like, are we talking about months? And I know you've been on this program saying that you're expecting that you need a new water treatment plant. What will it take for the city to get a new treatment center?
Yeah, a lot of money. You know, we've already been asking the government of Canada for $184 million for our long-term water supply pipes and other water infrastructure. You know, the water treatment plant wasn't within that ask, but, you know, we need a new plant. That plant's from 1962. It's been contaminated now twice, and we need to make sure that that doesn't continue to happen.
So it could be months. This situation could go on for months, right, Mayor?
Well, you know, I don't think so. I mean, we obviously have to fix this plant regardless of what happens. You know, we have an environmental team in there right now cleaning and scrubbing all the cement. This week, a cement expert's coming in to test the cement to see how hydrocarbons got through the cement into the water. You know, once we figure out all that, then, you know, obviously there's got to be some sort of engineering you know, fix for that, and we will undertake that. But, you know, our plant is, you know, literally about 50 feet, maybe 75 feet away from a power plant. And really, it shouldn't be there in the first place. So we ought to make sure that we fix this to make sure we don't have this keep on happening.
Always a space for you here to talk about a very critical issue for the thousands, more than 8,000 people in Iqaluit. Mayor Bell, thank you, sir, for joining us, and good luck. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, that is your Power Play Day in Politics. Thanks so much for watching. We will be back here in 23 short hours. Hug your loved ones. We hope it is safe to do so. We hope we're all together soon. Have a great evening. See you soon.